Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, October 7, 2021. Senate Democratic and Republican leaders announce a deal to raise the debt limit through early December, avoiding a first-ever default that could happen in just over a week. But some rank-and-file Republican senators not happy with the deal. We'll get the details from political reporter Caitlin Emma. Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats releasing a report on former President Donald Trump's attempt to get the Justice Department to overturn his loss in the 2020 presidential election. Committee Chair Dick Durbin saying the U.S. was a half step away from a constitutional crisis. White House applauds a federal judge's blocking, for now, Texas' restrictive abortion law. President Joe Biden in Chicago to promote COVID-19 vaccine mandates for government and businesses. And former special envoy to Haiti testifies before Congress about his resignation over the treatment of Haitian immigrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. And now to the debt limit agreement. Right after the Senate convened Thursday morning, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made this announcement from the Senate floor.
Madam President.
The Majority Leader.
Yes, for the information of members, I have a brief statement. I have some good news. We've reached an agreement on an extension of the debt ceiling through early September, and it's our hope that we can get this done today. September's passed already. Let me revise my statement. Madam President, we have reached agreement to extend the debt ceiling through early December, and it's our hope that we can get this done as soon as today. I yield the floor.
With more on the debt limit increase deal, we're joined by budget and appropriations reporter with Politico, Caitlin Emma. Thanks for being with us. So we have a deal, and we also have some issues getting to a final vote. But let's start with the deal itself. What are the details?
Absolutely. Well, it is really just a short-term fix. It would extend, basically increase the nation's borrowing limit by $480 billion through December 3rd, which is also when government funding is set to expire. So we're really pairing here the threat of default with a possible government shutdown, you know, just before the holidays, which is seems like a very typical thing for Congress to do. But it's a short-term patch, and it does very little to, you know, resolve the sort of underlying standoff that we've had over the debt ceiling for months now.
And what was the origin of that underlying standoff?
Really, the origin is this, you know, reconciliation process that Democrats are using to pass President Joe Biden's massive social spending bill. They are doing so without Republican votes. So Republican leaders have sort of said all along, you know, if you're going to do that, then you better use reconciliation to take care of the debt ceiling, too. You know, arguing that it needs to cover their borrowing and spending plans, which isn't entirely accurate because the debt limit technically only covers spending that has already been authorized by the federal government. So clearly the social spending bill hasn't done that yet. At the same time, you have Democrats arguing that Republicans are, you know, being negligent about their responsibility to address the debt ceiling, which has often necessitated bipartisan support. But looming in the background of all of this, you have the 2022 midterms, and Republicans would really like Democrats to really own a definitive hike to the debt ceiling so they can, you know, maybe use that as sort of like a political weapon next year when Democrats are trying to defend their very slim majorities.
And as you say, the deal announced today doesn't address that underlying problem. So as we reach December, we'll be back where we started from.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody, I was in a scrum yesterday in the Capitol, and somebody asked Senator Chris Murphy, you know, how are we going to ensure that we're just not right back where we are in late November? And he's like, well, you know, we can't. Like, we will be. We're just going to be having the same fight over again. And, you know, it's really worth noting that this December 3rd deadline, you know, is really the Treasury Department's best estimate for when it would, you know, run out of money again. But unlike certain actions that it took over the summer to keep paying the government's bills on time, the Treasury Department won't be able to do that again in this case. So there might be a little bit of wiggle room with that date, depending on how much money is coming in and federal cash flow. But you know, it really is sort of setting up a fiscal standoff just before the holidays, which really we've seen time and again over the last several years.
We're talking with Politico's Caitlin Emma. So the deal was announced Thursday morning by both the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. But then there was no vote. What was the reaction from the other Senate Republicans?
Right. So it's been a really chaotic 24 hours since this deal was basically announced. Essentially, Senator McConnell yesterday afternoon floated this notion of a short-term debt limit patch, and Republicans, basically both sides here are billing it as a win. Democrats are saying that, you know, McConnell has folded and, you know, he came around to a solution to take care of the debt ceiling after saying for months that Republicans wouldn't help at all. But at the same time, you have Republicans saying, you know, this is only so that they have time to address this with their own votes through the reconciliation process. You know, nothing changes here. So really, we've seen a lot of consternation from both parties, but especially Senate Republicans this afternoon have been, you know, somewhat uncomfortable with reaching an agreement that it would allow the measure to pass without a Republican filibuster in the Senate. So we are just sort of getting around to an agreement now on exactly how that would pass tonight. But, you know, at the moment, Democrats are going to need at least 10 Republicans to advance the debt ceiling increase later this evening. And, you know, it sort of remains to be seen who is going to break ranks there.
Caitlin Emma is a budget and appropriations reporter with Politico. Read her stories at politico.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And as an example of the parties saying, both parties saying the debt limit increase deal is a victory for them, as the final details were being negotiated Thursday night, Senator Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, was on CNN.
McConnell has blinked. President Biden and a unified Democratic caucus has consistently refused to move forward through reconciliation with raising the debt ceiling. Senator McConnell is now offering to have his caucus step aside and let Democrats, all 50 of us, come to the floor and vote for a short-term debt ceiling raise. And I think we will accept that so we can move forward with finishing the work to pass the Build Back Better agenda.
Senator Chris Coons, Democrat, on CNN Thursday evening. Here is how the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, spoke about this deal on the Senate floor this morning.
Republican and Democratic members and staff negotiated through the night in good faith. The Senate is moving toward the plan I laid out yesterday to spare the American people a manufactured crisis. All year, the Democratic government has made unprecedented and repeated use of reconciliation to pass radical policies on party line votes. So, back in July, Republicans informed our colleagues they would need to pursue any long-term increase in the debt ceiling through the same process. The President, the Speaker, and the Democratic leader had 3 months' notice to do their jobs. But for 2.5 months, the Democratic leaders did nothing and then complained that they were actually short on time. The majority didn't have a plan to prevent default, so we stepped forward. The pathway our Democratic colleagues have accepted will spare the American people any near-term crisis while definitively resolving the majority's excuse that they lacked time to address the debt limit through the 304 reconciliation process. Now there'll be no question they'll have plenty of time. Or if our colleagues would instead prefer a more traditional bipartisan discussion around basic governance, they can stop trying to ram through yet another reckless taxing and spending spree that would hurt families and help China. That would be the path toward that kind of discussion.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor Thursday morning. The Hill newspaper reporting mid-afternoon Thursday that Senator John Thune, the number two Senate Republican, said that 10 GOP senators will ultimately help advance the short-term debt hike, but predicted a painful process amid private haggling. He said, in the end, we'll be there, but it's going to be a painful birthing process. When asked about Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell's ability to get 10 GOP votes to advance the debt ceiling hike. GOP Senators Ted Cruz of Texas, Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul of Kentucky are requiring the debt hike legislation to overcome a filibuster, meaning it will require 60 votes to end the debate on the bill. That from The Hill. Well, at leading up to the vote, Senator Rand Paul, one of those Republicans, spoke on the floor, and his focus was that we shouldn't be focusing on the debt ceiling. We should be focusing on the overall spending that caused the problem in the first place, he says.
So we've accumulated $30 trillion in debt. Interest payments have been fairly low over the past decade or so. Interest payments are about, 1-2.5%. But now interest rates are rising. Even at the low interest rates, our interest rate that we pay each year has grown to about $300 billion a year. So $300 billion a year, and people say, well, there's a debt ceiling. If the debt ceiling doesn't come up, we'll default, and Wall Street will become hysterical, and there'll be a collapse of the stock market. Well, there doesn't need to be. Nobody really is for spreading discom or spreading, chaos among the marketplace. We all want the marketplace to be calm. How could we calm the marketplace? What we would say to the marketplace is, we'll pay our bills. We're not going to default on our currency. And the way you can pay for your bills is pay for it with income. We bring in $3.8 trillion a year in tax revenue. The interest payment is $300 billion. It's less than we bring in 1 month. So the annual payment on interest is less than what we bring in tax revenue in 1 month. Why can't we pay the interest? Why would we ever not pay the interest on our debt? Why? Because we're overdrawn and because all the rest of the spending is crowded out by the interest. We've got plenty of money to pay for the interest. We just don't have enough left to pay for the cocaine studies with Japanese quail. That's about $1 million. You say, it's only $1 million. Well, they studied Japanese quail to see whether or not Japanese quail on cocaine, to see if they're more sexually promiscuous. How did we get to a $30 trillion debt? Because there's studies like that littered throughout the budget.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. Reaction from Wall Street to what's been happening in Washington. The Dow up 337, NASDAQ up 152, S&P up 36. This is Washington Today. From Associated Press, a report by the Senate Judiciary Committee's Democratic majority details Donald Trump's extraordinary effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election that he lost, with the Justice Department brought to the brink of chaos and top officials there and at the White House threatening to resign. The Democrats' report chronicles Trump's relentless prodding of the Justice Department during a turbulent stretch in December and early January to investigate suspected voter fraud and to support his efforts to undo the election. The Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, speaking about the report today on the Senate floor.
When William Barr, President Trump's attorney general at the time, issued a statement saying there was no evidence of widespread fraud in the election. That was disappointing to the president. It occurred that in the middle of December of last year, William Barr, the attorney general, announced that he was going to resign as of December 23rd. A man was chosen as the acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen. And at his side, Richard O'Donohue, Deputy Attorney General. There was a full court press on from that moment by President Trump and his supporters to influence Jeffrey Rosen into intervening into this election contest. When I say full court press, I'm talking about repeated telephone calls and meetings in the White House over a period of 2 weeks. This report, which we have brought to the attention of the public as well as members of the committee, obviously, went into detail as to what happened during that two-week period of time. It was an incredible moment, which most Americans didn't even know was going on. We were a half step away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, because what the president was trying to do was to convince the attorney general to contact the leaders in the states where he thought, the president thought, he had won the election, and to tell them to not certify the results and to pick an alternative set of electors in some instances. In each of these cases, the president was, President Trump was pushing a theory on why he actually won. These theories went from crazy to silly to outlandish.
Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, chair of the Judiciary Committee on the Senate floor. Washington Post national security reporter Devlin Barrett has been looking into the committee's findings. He joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your article focuses on a key confrontation in the Oval Office January 3rd. What does the report say about this?
Well, the report provides a lot more detail to a meeting we already knew about, but gives a lot more context to just how fraught the conversation was, just how many government lawyers were willing to resign if President Trump went through with this plan to replace the attorney general in the final days. And so it really just sort of fills out all the color and detail of that meeting and what Democrats call a near constitutional crisis.
Well, Senator Durbin did use that phrase a couple of times today in on the floor of the Senate in interviews, half step away from a constitutional crisis. Is that a fair analysis based on their investigation?
Well, I think if President Trump had gone ahead and replaced the attorney general, it's pretty clear you would have seen a raft of resignations, not just at the top of the Justice Department. But, one of the things we learned in this report is that there was also the prospect of a lot of U.S. attorneys around the country resigning in protest as well. And so I do think there is some justification for thinking that could have spun out of control very quickly. But also, to be fair, the Republicans argue that, look, at the end of the day, the president backed away from this plan. He didn't do any of those things. So it wasn't that much of a crisis.
You mentioned that the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee putting out their own set of findings. What are they saying?
Well, their main argument is, look, the president didn't go through with it, so it's not that big of a deal. I think to folks at the Justice Department, however, this was a very big deal and a very frightening episode in terms of trying to keep the Justice Department out of sort of the intense political fray surrounding the election. And it seemed like at times for the leadership of the Justice Department, it seemed like the only way to do that was to threaten mass resignation.
Is there anything in the Judiciary Committee report, the Democrats' report, that says that former President Trump or anyone else did anything that could be construed as criminal? Does it ever get to that point?
No, they've recommended, they've asked various officials to look at the possibility of bar sanctions on some of the lawyers involved in this, and they've essentially thrown out the possibility that some of this may be criminal. To be honest, I think that's a very heavy lift because you're talking about senior government officials debating policy and practice decisions at the head of the Justice Department. I think it's a little far-fetched to sort of ever put that in a courtroom on trial, but that's not to minimize the conduct is okay. I think there's a lot of things that you can fairly say is bad behavior that is not actually criminal behavior. But I guess the way I think of it is this. The criminal code of the United States was not written to cover the deliberations among senior officials over election law. Like it's just not anything that the criminal code sort of envisions dealing with. And so I think it's a reach, but certainly there are a lot of Democrats who would like to see this pursued as a criminal matter.
We're talking with Devlin Barrett from the Washington Post. Former President Donald Trump, who still disputes the election results, has been putting out statements through various organizations that he's affiliated with. Has he responded to this report?
I haven't seen a response yet to this report. You know, the Trump and his supporters have always taken the argument of that, you know, he's fulfilling his duties as president to make sure that the election was legitimate and wasn't a victim of fraud. I think what's hard to swallow for a lot of people about that argument is as then acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen said to him over and over and over again, just because you see something on the internet doesn't mean it's true. And, you know, what the Justice Department kept saying to then President Trump was, we have looked into that and it's just not true. And he repeatedly refused to take that as an acceptable answer.
Washington Post national security reporter Devlin Barrett. Read his stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Donald Trump intends to assert executive privilege in a congressional investigation into the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, writes the Associated Press, a move that could prevent the testimony of one-time aides, according to a letter sent by lawyers for the former president. Also, the recently completed audit of the presidential vote in Maricopa County, Arizona, the subject of a hearing in Washington, D.C., before the House Oversight and Reform Committee. The chair is Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York. And she said she wished one witness who was invited to testify had shown up.
Last month, Cyber Ninjas finally was forced to admit that it found no evidence of widespread fraud in the Maricopa County election results. In its final report, Cyber Ninjas wrote that they were, quote, no substantial differences, end quote, between the official count and the audit results, and that there is, quote, no reliable evidence that the paper ballots were altered to any material degree, end quote. This should have been the end of the story. But rather than admit that they were wrong about voter fraud, Cyber Ninjas and Republican leaders in Arizona are now pushing a host of unnecessary legislative changes to make it harder to vote and easier to overturn election results. And hyperpartisan audits are now spreading to more states. We are holding today's hearing so we can hear the facts about the Cyber Ninja audits in Arizona. We invited the company's CEO, Doug Logan, to testify today so that we could hear firsthand about the audit's findings. Unfortunately, Mr. Logan refused our invitation, and he also refused to produce documents that the committee requested back in July. Mr. Logan's refusal to answer questions under oath is just one more sign that the dark money-fueled audit he led never should have happened in the first place.
Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, chair of the Oversight and Reform Committee, at today's hearing. That audit of Maricopa County, led by the company Cyber Ninjas, finding what the original results of the election were in 2020, and that is that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in that county. One of the invited witnesses who did appear at today's hearing in Washington was Jack Sellers. He is chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, a Republican, and he did not support this audit.
We ran a presidential preference election in February. All participants agreed it was well-run and accurate. We ran the primary election in August of 2020. Again, the public, the candidates, and the political parties all agreed the county's election execution was excellent. We ran the 2020 general election in November, and suddenly, what to that point had been a great process was deemed fatally flawed by a small yet loud minority. I dare say if you're a student of Maricopa County Republican election history, you are not surprised by the results. It was not a flawed election process, not a lack of security. It was a candidate that many Maricopa County Republicans simply did not support. If that lesson is not clear to our state and county Republican leaders, then I'm afraid 2022 will not be favorable to my party. During these last 10 months, I've learned a lot about people. And frankly, I was naive in thinking that I could just sit down with our state Senate leadership and explain the answers to their questions and accusations, and we could put this uncertainty behind us and move on with securing a fruitful future for our residents. But it's become clear that there are those who don't care what the facts are. They just want to gain political power and raise money by fostering mistrust of the greatest power an individual can exercise in the United States, their vote. I'm an elected official. Some say I signed up for this, and that's true. But I ran because economic development and maintaining our quality of life is very important to me. Making sure the Valley of the Sun has the proper investment in infrastructure, technology, and education is what drives me. Relitigating a failed campaign is not what drives me. So it's time to move on. It's time to put our efforts into securing a greater future for our country, and that's exactly what I plan to do. Thank you.
Jack Sellers chairs the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in Arizona, testifying before the House Oversight and Reform Committee in Washington. Some Republican members of the committee still raising questions about the presidential vote. Here is Andy Biggs of Arizona in an exchange with Democrat Jimmy Raskin of Maryland.
It was amazing and yet telling for me to hear the gentleman from Arizona. I think he's trying to elide the fact that this audit rejected the claim that Donald Trump won in Arizona. I never really understood members from Arizona challenging the result by which they themselves were elected in the exact same election where they were elected. And yet still, I believe, and perhaps Mr. Biggs can correct me if I'm wrong, I hear him not even to be accepting the results of this audit, which say that Joe Biden got more votes than were lawfully reported by the state. And so,
will the gentleman yield? You've called me out and asked if I would respond. I'm happy to respond.
Yes, but by all means, do you accept this audit, which showed that Joe Biden won, and indeed by more votes than?
That is not what the audit concluded, Mr. Raskin. You know better than that. Have you read the whole audit? Are you cherry picked the line which talks about the recount versus the tabulation machines? That we would have expected to be very similar, and it was. And so, anything that might have inured to President Biden's effect.
Who won the election is my question, Mr. Biggs. I'm happy to yield to you for that. Who won the election in Arizona? Donald Trump?
We don't know, because as the audit, it demonstrates very clearly, Mr. Raskin, there are a lot of issues with this election that took place. We're going to go through those today, but you can continue, speaking of the big lie, you can continue to perpetuate it as long as you want, but we're going to find out.
I'll reclaim my time. Madam Chair, there is the problem that we have. Donald Trump refused to accept the results. And unfortunately, we have one of the world's great political parties, which has followed him off of the ledge of this electoral lunacy. And it's dangerous for democracy. So I'm glad we're having this hearing today. And I yield back to you, Madam Chair.
Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin in exchange with Republican Congressman Andy Biggs at the House Oversight and Reform Committee hearing. You can find the full hearing at our website, archived at cspan.org. Statesman Journal out of Salem, Oregon, has a story that reads, 11 months after the 2020 election, county clerks in Oregon are getting a new round of calls and emails disputing the results. Marion County Clerk Bill Burgess saying, people, they come and they'll start asking the questions, and then they won't wait for an answer. They'll start railing away, and sometimes with a lot of obscenity and all that. The article noting that in the 2020 presidential election, voters in the county swung to Democrat Joe Biden over Republican Donald Trump by 49.2% to 48%, and that was a reversal of the 2016 election when Trump carried the county. Texas says it's going to appeal the court order blocking the state's restrictive abortion law after a federal judge Wednesday night calling the law an offensive deprivation of such an important right. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton tweeting this morning, the sanctity of human life is and always will be a top priority for me. We disagree with the court's decision, have already taken steps to immediately appeal to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. U.S. Attorney General here in Washington, Merrick Garland, calling the ruling a victory for women in Texas and for the rule of law. Reaction from the Deputy White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre. She was traveling with the president on Air Force One.
How does the judge's ruling on the Texas abortion law affect the White House's strategy on this issue going forward?
So yesterday's ruling, Jeff, as you just mentioned, is an important step forward toward restoring the constitutional rights of women across the state of Texas. As the president said, SB 8 not only blatantly violates the right to safe and legal abortion established under Roe v. Wade, but it creates a scheme to allow private citizens to interfere with that right and to evade judicial review. The fight has only just begun, but in Texas and in many states across the country where women's rights are currently under attack. That's why the president supports codifying Roe v. Wade, why he has directed a whole of government response to SB 8, and why he will continue to stand side by side with women across the country to protect their constitutional rights.
That's the Principal Deputy White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters on Air Force One. The Justice Department sued Texas last month after the Supreme Court declined to block the abortion law in a 5-4 decision that did not rule on whether the abortion time limit, 6 weeks, and the enforcement mechanism, private lawsuits, are constitutional. The department then filed an emergency motion to try to prevent Texas from enforcing the law while the lawsuit moves through the courts, and that was granted. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Find it on our mobile app, C-SPAN Now, or wherever you get your podcasts. President Joe Biden in Chicago area today, promoting COVID-19 vaccine mandates, meeting with elected and business leaders who have implemented these mandates, including the governor, J.B. Pritzker, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, and United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby. The president touring a construction site in Elk Grove Village, about 20 miles outside of the city. It's being built by construction company Clayco, and making some remarks promoting those mandates.
I recently met with the CEOs of Disney, Microsoft, who you're familiar with here, Walgreens, to hear about their requirements. The Business Roundtable represents 200 of the largest businesses in the world, and it has championed vaccination requirements to keep businesses open and workers safe. America's largest aerospace companies, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, who I met with yesterday, the chairman of the board, Northrop Grumman, they all just announced plans to implement vaccination requirements. Even this I always get a kick out of. Fox News. Fox News requires vaccinations for all employees. Give me a break. Fox News. And over the past week, we've seen American, Southwest, Alaska, JetBlue Airlines all announce requirements. The leaders of Chicago are stepping up. As I said, the mayor, Mayor Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker are requiring vaccinations for state and city workers, healthcare workers, and teachers. Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce here, Jack Levin, who is here, has called for all members of his of the chamber to require vaccinations for their employees going back to work in person. And I came here to Clayco to thank this company for doing the right thing. Today, Clayco is announcing it's going to require all employees to be fully vaccinated or test once a week. It matters. I know these decisions aren't easy, but you're setting an example and a powerful example. Second thing I'd like to say, today's report shows that vaccination requirements are good for the economy. Not only increase in vaccination rates, but to help send people back to work. Back to work.
President Biden at Elk Grove Village, Illinois, near Chicago. Drug company Pfizer saying today it has submitted a formal application to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization of its COVID-19 vaccine in children ages 5 to 11. This was expected. An FDA advisory committee plans to meet to discuss the application on October 26th. Currently, no COVID vaccine is approved for children under 12. Back here in Washington, D.C., jockeying continues over how big the social spending and tax bill the Democrats are putting together will be and what will be in it. It's the one being passed under that process called budget reconciliation, which cannot be filibustered by the Republicans, but does require all Democrats to support it in order to pass. Talks continuing between Democratic leaders and the two current Democratic holdout senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who want a smaller package. White House confirming that President Biden meeting with Joe Manchin today. But Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts also saying today for himself and a couple of other Democrats, if you take out climate change programs, you're going to lose my vote.
So here's the deal. Climate cannot and will not be cut. No climate, no deal. Climate solutions must remain up front and center in this reconciliation package. When Congress was negotiating infrastructure this summer, Senators Wyden and Smith and Van Hollen and I said very clearly, no climate, no deal. We stand fast to that pledge. This package must include a civilian climate corps to employ, train, and mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to fight the imminent threat of climate change, all while getting paid a fair wage and securing educational and health care benefits for all of those workers. This package must include my clean energy accelerator with Senator Van Hollen to bring public and private financing for emissions reducing projects directly into the communities that need them the most.
Right.
And we will continue to fight for a strong set of clean electricity policies that Senator Smith has championed that jumpstart the clean energy revolution and deliver renewable, affordable electricity to Americans. And this package must include the tax breaks crafted by Senator Wyden for our clean energy technologies that create good-paying union jobs here in the United States. We can also take this opportunity to strike outdated, unnecessary, decades-old tax breaks for fossil fuels and make polluters pay. And let me be clear, natural gas is not clean energy, and it is not climate action. It is possible to find middle ground in many areas of politics. I know because I have done it. But we cannot compromise on science. There isn't a middle ground between a livable and unlivable world.
Senator Ed Markey at a news conference outside the U.S. Capitol building with climate activists from the Hip Hop Caucus and Sunrise Movement, joined by three other Democratic senators, Ron Wyden of Oregon, Tina Smith of Minnesota, Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. Republicans have, by and large, spoken out against the social spending and tax plans being proposed by the Democrats. One bit of the proposal, though, getting a lot of attention from those Senate Republicans, as the Wall Street Journal editorial board put it on Monday, on your next trip to the ATM, imagine that Uncle Sam is looking over your shoulder. As if your annual tax filing wasn't evasive enough, the Biden administration would like to look at your checking account. Charles Rettig, commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, wants banks to report annual cash flows for ordinary account holders. That was from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming speaking about this today on the Senate floor.
Democrats are asking in this $3.5 trillion bill, $80 billion of additional funding for the Internal Revenue Service. They want to give the IRS enough money and power to hire a full new army of bureaucrats. President Biden's Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has been very clear. She knows what she wants to do with some of the money. She wants to force banks to tell the IRS every time anyone writes or deposits a check above a certain amount in their banking account, checking account. And right now, the number that she's talking about is $600. $600 for a check, written or deposited. So every time someone pays the rent, deposits a paycheck, Democrats want the IRS to know about it. Not enough to know that government knows how much people make. They want to know how much they spend. It's Big Brother initiative to squeeze every last penny out of working families. I mean, why else would they want to go after every hardworking man and woman in America to find out this information? As Americans find out about that, they are furious. They're smart enough to know that when Joe Biden first says, we're only going to tax the billionaires, they're only going to tax the billionaires, why are they looking into the banking accounts and the checking accounts and the deposits and the withdrawals of people all across the country? It's because the tax man is coming for them as well when it comes to trying to pay for this massive tax and spending blowout. So as more and more people find out about it, the more furious they become. I got a report again this morning, 488 more emails and letters into Wyoming, into the senator from Wyoming about that from my home state. I have received more calls, more emails, more letters from people from Wyoming on this one topic than on any one topic that I can recall in the time that I've been in the United States Senate. And everyone calling and writing about it has the same position. It's not like, well, half of the people are for it, half of the people are against it. Everybody is against this. Everyone we have heard from, the 488 that I heard from within the last 24 hours, everyone against this proposal.
Senator John Barrasso on the Senate floor. He was joined by other Senate Republicans, including Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who tried to bring up a bill to, as he puts it, prohibit any federal agency from requiring financial institutions to report on the financial transactions of their customers. Tuberville asking that the bill be brought up and passed under unanimous consent. That requires the okay from every senator. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, chair of the Finance Committee, objected and then explained why.
IRS Commissioner Rettig, a Republican appointee, came before the Finance Committee earlier this year and said the total amount of taxes evaded each year could be as high as $1 trillion. Cheating by those at the very top is one of the major causes of that huge tax gap. A big reason why is that the automatic reporting and strict rules that apply to the typical hardworking taxpayer, nurses and firefighters, for example, they don't always apply to those at the top. That means that tax cheats are able to hide their cheating in the shadows. The senator's proposal would help them keep it that way. This proposal would make it extraordinarily difficult to collect the information necessary to crack down on the high-flying tax cheats. Now, the argument against information reporting is always the same, and it's been consistently wrong. Despite what opponents say, what President Biden and Democrats have proposed is focused on rooting out tax cheating at the top. It wouldn't apply to accounts with deposits and withdrawals under $10,000. And for most people, that's $10,000 on top of your paycheck. It's not about anybody's transactions. They wouldn't be reported, colleagues. It wouldn't create any new surveillance of digital currency. This information reporting proposal is about reporting only two numbers, the total amount going into an account and the total amount going out of it. Social Security income does not count either.
Senator Ron Wyden on the Senate floor. This is Washington Today. Associated Press reporting that the number of U.S.-bound Haitian migrants temporarily stuck in northern Colombia has risen to about 20,000, a senior U.S. official said Thursday, echoing reports from a local human rights organization. The official briefing reporters on condition he not be named. He said it's forming a human bottleneck. The former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, testified today before the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee, talking about his recent resignation, this after the U.S. expelled more than 7,000 Haitian migrants who were in an earlier encampment trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in Del Rio, Texas. Questioning Daniel Foote, Congresswoman Kathy Manning, Democrat from Michigan.
So let me start by talking once again about the immigration issue, because in your resignation letter, you referenced the inhumane, what you call the counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees, and talked about the surging migration to our borders, which will only add to Haiti's unacceptable misery. So I wonder if you could talk to us about what you think the Biden administration should have done to better handle the border surge.
It's always easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, right? But you know, first of all, I was astounded, and I guess this is my own naivete because I'm not as important as I thought I was, but nobody asked me about the deportations. I found out about it on the news, just like the rest of us. And you would think, I thought, you know, I'm the special envoy, so maybe when we're making policy decisions, someone comes to me and says, is this good? Is this bad? But it didn't happen. What I would have liked to say, see, is hang on, time out. We got 15,000 Haitians. We're going to be here. Let's figure out how to treat them humanely and the path forward to process them, and then arrive at the point where either they're deported or let into the country or they stay in Mexico or whatever. And what I saw is a plan. As soon as I saw it on the news, I started poking around in my email, and I saw, I thought, a plan to deport the majority of those people. And that's against international law. It's called refoulement. I have had tense discussions with other countries about doing that before, and now the United States is doing it. And I just couldn't be associated with the treatment and just the knee-jerk decision to send them back to Port-au-Prince. And many of them, I don't know if you've seen on the news, they get back to Port-au-Prince and they're interviewed and they say they're going back. That's the first thing they say.
Daniel Foote is a career member of the Senior Foreign Service and was U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti from July 22nd until his resignation September 23rd, testifying today before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. NBC News has a story that begins the U.S. knew in July that thousands of Haitians were heading to the U.S. border, but a failure to share intelligence and an internal debate over whether to increase deportations left immigration officials ill-equipped to handle the 28,000 who converged on a Texas bridge last month. That according to three U.S. officials talking with NBC News. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. To get top Washington stories sent to you each day, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. And I hope you have a good night.